Travels with a Donkey in the Cevennes by Robert Louis Stevenson. Episode 4, Our Lady of the Snows.
Father Michael, a pleasant, fresh-faced, smiling man, perhaps of 35, took me to the pantry and gave me a glass of liqueur to stay me until dinner. We had some talk, or rather I should say he listened to my prattling indulgently enough, but with an abstracted air, like a spirit with a thing of clay. And truly, when I remember that I descanted principally on my appetite, and that it must have been by that time more than 18 hours since Father Michael had so much as broken bread, I can well understand that he would find an earthy savour in my conversation. But his manner, though superior, was exquisitely gracious. And I find I have a lurking curiosity as to Father Michael's past. The wet administered, I was left alone for a little in the monastery garden. This is no more than the main court, laid out in sandy paths and beds of part-coloured dahlias, with a fountain and a black statue of the Virgin in the centre. The buildings stand around it four square, bleak, as yet unseasoned by the years and weather, and with no other features than a belfry and a pair of slated gables. Brothers in white, brothers in brown, passed silently among the sanded alleys. And when I first came out, three hooded monks were kneeling on the terrace at their prayers. For my part, on this wild September day, before I was called to dinner, I felt chilly, in and out. When I had eaten well and heartily, Brother Ambrose, a hearty, conversable Frenchman, for all those who wait on strangers have the liberty to speak, led me to a little room in that part of the building which is set apart for Messieurs les Retraitants. It was clean and whitewashed, and furnished with strict necessaries, a crucifix, a bust of the late Pope, the Imitation in French, a book of religious meditations, and the Life of Elizabeth Seton. Evangelist, it would appear, of North America and of New England in particular. Over the table, to conclude the inventory of the room, hung a set of regulations for Messieurs les Retraitants, what services they should attend, when they were to tell their beads or meditate, and when to rise and go to rest. I had scarce explored my niche when Brother Ambrose returned. An English boarder, it appeared, would like to speak with me. I professed my willingness, and the friar ushered in a fresh young little Irishman of 50, a deacon of the church, arrayed in strict canonicals and wearing on his head what, in default of knowledge, I can only call the ecclesiastical shako. He had lived 7 years in retreat at a convent of nuns in Belgium, and now 5 at Our Lady of the Snows. He showed me his room, where he passed his time among breviaries, Hebrew Bibles, and the Waverley novels. Thence he led me to the cloisters, into the chapter house, through the vestry, where the brothers' gowns and broad straw hats were hanging up, each with his religious name upon a board, into the library, where were all the works of Vaillot and Chateaubriand, and the Odes et Ballades, if you please, and even Molière, to say nothing of innumerable fathers and a great variety of local and general historians. Thence my good Irishman took me round the workshops, where brothers bake bread and make cartwheels and take photographs, where one superintends a collection of curiosities, and another a gallery of rabbits. For in a Trappist monastery, each monk has an occupation of his own choice, apart from his religious duties and the general labours of the house. Each must sing in the choir, if he has a voice and ear, and join in the haymaking, if he has a hand to stir. But in his private hours, although he must be occupied, he may be occupied on what he likes. In all these journeyings, many silent fathers and brethren fell in our way. Usually they paid no more regard than if we'd been a cloud. But sometimes the good deacon had a permission to ask of them, and it was granted by a peculiar movement of the hands, almost like that of a dog's paws in swimming, or refused by the usual negative signs, and in either case with lowered eyelids and a certain air of contrition, as of a man who is steering very close to evil. That night I took my place in the gallery to hear Compline and Salve Regina, with which the Cistercians bring every day to a conclusion. A stern simplicity, heightened by the romance of the surroundings, spoke directly to the heart. I recall the whitewashed chapel, the hooded figures in the choir, the lights alternately occluded and revealed, the strong, manly singing, the silence that ensued, the sight of cowled heads bowed in prayer, and then the clear, trenchant beating of the bell, breaking in to show that the last office was over and the hour of sleep had come. I made my escape into the court with somewhat whirling fancies, and stood like a man bewildered in the starry night. But I was weary, and when I had quieted my spirits with Elizabeth Seton's memoirs, a dull work, the cold and the wind among the pines, for my room was on that side of the monastery which adjoins the woods, disposed me readily to slumber. I was wakened at what seemed black midnight, but was really 2 in the morning, by the first stroke upon the bell. All the brothers were then hurrying to the chapel. The dead in life at this untimely hour were already beginning the uncomforted labours of their day. And I blessed God that I was free to wander, free to hope, and free to love. But there was another side to my residence at Our Lady of the Snows. I had dined alone because I arrived late, but at supper I found 2 other guests. One was a country parish priest who had walked over that morning from the seat of his cure near Mende to enjoy 4 days of solitude and prayer. He was a grenadier in person, with the hale colour and circular wrinkles of a peasant, and as he complained much of how he had been impeded by his skirts upon the march, I have a vivid fancy portrait of him, striding along, upright, big-boned, with kilted cassock, through the bleak hills of Gévaudan. The other was a short, grizzling, thick-set man dressed in tweed with a knitted spencer and the red ribbon of a decoration in his buttonhole. He was hard to classify. He was an old soldier who had seen service and risen to the rank of commandant, and he retained some of the brisk, decisive manners of the camp. On the other hand, as soon as his resignation was accepted, he had come to Our Lady of the Snows as a boarder, and after a brief experience of its ways, had remained as a novice. At supper we talked politics. I make it my business, when in France, to preach political goodwill and moderation, and to dwell on the example of Poland, much as some alarmists in England dwell on that of Carthage. The priest and his commandant assured me of their sympathy with all I said, and made a heavy sighing over the bitterness of contemporary feeling. "Why, you cannot say anything to a man with which he does not absolutely agree," said I, "but he flies up at you in a temper." They both declared that such a state of things was anti-Christian. While we were thus agreeing, what should my tongue stumble upon but a word in praise of Gambetta's moderation? The old soldier's countenance was instantly suffused with blood. With the palms of his hands, he beat the table like a naughty child. "Come on, monsieur," he shouted. "Come on. Gambetta, moderate. Will you dare justify these words?" But the priest had not forgotten the tenor of our talk, and suddenly, in the height of his fury, the old soldier found a warning look directed on his face. The absurdity of his behaviour was brought home to him in a flash, and the storm came to an abrupt end without another word. It was only in the morning that this couple found out I was a heretic. I suppose I had misled them by some admiring expressions as to the monastic life around us, and it was only by a point-blank question that the truth came out. I had been tolerantly used both by simple Father Apollinaris and astute Father Michael, and the good Irish deacon, when he heard of my religious weakness, simply patted me upon the shoulder and said, "You must be a Catholic and come to heaven." But I was now among a different set of Orthodox. These 2 men were bitter and upright and narrow, like the worst of Scotsmen, and indeed, upon my heart, I fancy they were worse. The priest snorted aloud like a battle horse when I humbly indicated that I had no design of changing. He could not away with such a monstrous attitude. "No, no," he cried, "you must change. You have come here, God has led you here, and you must embrace the opportunity." I made a slip in policy. I appealed to the family affections. Though I was speaking to a priest and a soldier, 2 classes of men circumstantially divorced from the kind and homely ties of life. "Your father and your mother?" cried the priest. Very well. You will convert them in their turn when you go home. I think I see my father's face. I would rather tackle the Getulian lion in his den than embark on such an enterprise against the family theologian. But now the hunt was up. Priest and soldier were in full cry for my conversion. It was an odd but most convincing proselytizing. They never sought to convince me in argument, where I might have attempted some defence, but took it for granted that I was both ashamed and terrified at my position, and urged me solely on the point of time. Now, they said, when God had led me to Our Lady of the Snows, was the appointed hour. For one who feels very similarly to all sects of religion, and who has never been able even for a moment to weigh seriously the merit of this or that creed on the eternal side of things, however much he may see to praise or blame upon the secular or temporal side, the situation thus created was both unfair and painful. I committed my second fault intact, and tried to plead that it was all the same thing in the end, and we were all drawing near by different sides to the same undiscriminating friend and father. That, as it seems to lay spirits, would be the only gospel worthy of the name. But different men think differently, and this revolutionary aspiration brought down the priest with all the terrors of the law. He launched into harrowing details of hell. The damned, he said, on the authority of a little book which he had read not a week before, and which, to add conviction to conviction, he had fully intended to bring along with him in his pocket, were to occupy the same attitude through all eternity in the midst of dismal tortures. And as he thus expiated, he grew in nobility of aspect with his enthusiasm. As a result, the pair concluded that I should seek out the prior, since the abbot was from home, and lay my case immediately before him. At this moment in came one of the monks, a little brown fellow with an Italian accent, who threw himself at once into the contention, but in a milder and more persuasive vein. "Look at him," he said. The rule was hard. He would have dearly liked to stay in his own country, Italy. It was well known how beautiful it was, but there were no Trappists in Italy, and he had a soul to save, and here he was. I'm afraid I must be at bottom what a cheerful Indian critic has dubbed me, a faddling hedonist, for this description of the brother's motives gave me somewhat of a shock. I should have preferred to think he had chosen the life for its own sake, and not for ulterior purposes. Besides, I was by this time so thoroughly embarrassed that I pleaded cold feet and made my escape from the apartment. At dinner, the work of the propagation was recommenced, and on this occasion more distastefully to me. The priest asked me many questions as to the contemptible faith of my fathers, and received my replies with a kind of ecclesiastical titter. At length I grew annoyed beyond endurance, and although he was on his own ground, and an old man, I could not avoid a protest against such uncivil usage. He was sadly discountenanced. "I assure you," he said, "I have no inclination to laugh in my heart. I have no other feeling but interest in your soul." And there ended my conversion. Honest man! He was no dangerous deceiver, but a country parson full of zeal and faith. Long may he tread Gévaudan with his kilted skirts, a man strong to walk and strong to comfort his parishioners in death. I dare say he would beat bravely through a snowstorm where his duty called him. And it is not always the most faithful believer who makes the cunningest apostle.
Alan Cumming was reading the fourth episode of Travels with a Donkey in the Cevennes by Robert Louis Stevenson.